Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Derek Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. As many of you know, I recently earned my PhD in religious studies, writing about psychedelic and visionary mysticism in the early 1970s. And after being an independent writer, scholar, journalist for over 20 years before getting into the degree, I learned a lot of things when I entered into academia. And one of the things I learned was that there were a lot of disciplines, a lot of sub-disciplines, and that a lot of the conversations you have and the writings that you do have to do with how you organize and relate to different things, anthropology, psychology, and then subsets of all of these, breaking off into a myriad of different discussions with different kinds of languages and different kinds of issues. So it's a bit bewildering. But of all of the, and because I'm a somewhat, well, I shouldn't say somewhat, I'm a pretty interdisciplinary thinker, including being interested in disciplines or ways of thinking that are very much outside the academy, it was a very creative and entertaining challenge, if sometimes a frustrating one, not one that I would say I did as well as I could have, because it's really quite a daunting intellectual task to move between different disciplines and really take them seriously and honor the kind of languages that they have developed. But of all of these disciplines, the one that by far and away was the most felt like home base for me was the study of esotericism, which is a relatively new field inside intellectual history, but also, of course, touching on issues in psychology and anthropology and sociology. But it's really the study of the esoteric or occult currents, mostly inside of the West. And this is looking at the history of Hermeticism, of alchemy, of Gnostic ideas, of the Tarot, and where these things actually come from, and how do we think about them in terms of the larger currents of Western, particularly Western history. And I just found that the people who were doing this kind of work were writing things I was very interested in. And when I met them, I often found that they were particularly friendly and engaging and entertaining people. And there was something sort of had a little extra special pizzazz. And I think it's partly because without knowing the personal backgrounds of a lot of the scholars that I was talking to, it's sort of clear that you have to be a kind of particular sort of person to be interested in studying this fairly esoteric material, which even from an academic perspective is seen by a lot of people as being fairly fringe. I think that's changing now as people recognize how central these currents are to not just Western history, but to things that are happening now. And so I think that it's more and more of a recognized zone. But I really quite enjoyed the conferences and conversations that I had with people who were studying esotericism. And though I haven't been able to spend as much time with him personally as I would like, today's guest is a standout figure in the field. Gil Asperum is sort of the rising star of the field, if you would put it. A lot of the people who helped organize esotericism as a distinct historical field are getting on, and you can still meet and hang out with them, and they're pretty cool. And Egil is a younger man, and he's just blazing a trail. He's incredibly productive. His work is very, very incisive. He's a very careful scholar. So he's not a razzle-dazzle visionary in terms of, writing crazy, obscure visions and sort of cramming them into academic prose, which is something I feel like I tend to do a little bit more. But he's instead an extremely careful historian and someone who works in between, again, different disciplines, particularly sociology, the history of science, and the history of occultism in a way that's incredibly illuminating and really transforms your view. I'm sad to say that his great book, which is based on his dissertation, The Problem of Disenchantment, is incredibly expensive. However, for those of you, and I do encourage people who are interested in the kinds of conversations we have here on Expanding Mind to pursue his work, that He has a great blog called Heterodoxology, heterodoxology.com. And also, I encourage you all to join academia.edu, even if you're not a scholar or an academic, because a lot of people post their papers on there now, so it's an easy way of downloading a lot of material without having to sneak onto JSTOR or the other paywall sources of academic information. Egil is very generous with his papers there, and that's often an easier way to get a sense of where people are coming from than these, you know, monster tomes, which really take quite a lot of commitment. So I'm very happy to have Egil on the show. He also just told me in our chat beforehand that he after the usual nomadic life of the young scholar, hopping from one institution to another on postdocs and grants and adjunct gigs, et cetera, he's landed a solid job at the University of Stockholm. So I want to congratulate him on that, and I'm sure that's feels good after all that peripatetic wandering. So Egil, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me. That was a very flattering introduction you had there.
Yeah, well, it's fun. You deserve it. you know, I wanted to start, as I mentioned, you predominantly done work in the history of esotericism and particularly as it relates to science. But in the last few years, you've increasingly come to engage cognitive science and really going deep into what cognitive science, which is sort of based on neuroscientific ideas and some ideas in evolutionary psychology, but kind of has its own character, its own way of thinking about the mind and thinking about how we think about the world. And this is increasingly an important field within the study of religion, not just esotericism, but religion in general, so much so that some old school humanists and old school people in the field and other fields feel a bit of an assault coming, as if the sciences in the guise of cognitive science are going to come in and rewrite all their interests according to some narrow kind of scientistic way of thinking about the world. It's an opinion I don't share, and I know you don't either. But I'd love to hear a little bit about, coming from a pretty historical basis and talking about occultism and occult ideas and practices and how they've flowed through history, what was it about cognitive science that started to draw you more and more and became an increasingly important part of your work? And what about it as a way of approaching these things seems so rich for you?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think there's actually several ways I could answer that question. One thing being that as you well know, the field of esotericism is just such a rich field in terms of weird experiential accounts, strange, well, sometimes fairly bizarre ways of thinking that you see in some of these texts and that these people are going about doing. Also practices that are there for, you know, invoking angels or sending demons on people or communicating with all sorts of spirits. So all of this stuff just seems extremely rich. And one of the things that kind of frustrated me a little bit with the historians that were working on this, and I mean, partially myself included in this category, was that we simply lacked the tools to really touch on what's going on in these accounts. And it's not only due to the fact that we're dealing with historical material, you know, stuff that's a couple of hundred years old, and you can't access for that reason, but also just I perceived a kind of a hesitation with trying to engage the sort of theories that we do have, the kind of knowledge that we do have about the human mind that could help us at least approximate some idea of what's going on in some of these sources. So that's one of the kind of frustrations that led me to become more and more deciding that we needed to engage this new field of cognitive science of religion, which had basically been developing in parallel with the study of esotericism over the last 20 years, carving out a space for itself as an interdisciplinary field within religious studies. So I thought there would be a lot of potential, potentially fruitful conversations to be had between esotericism and the cognitive science of religion, And I just wanted to take some first sort of preliminary steps to try and have such a conversation. And that's basically what I've been doing now over the last couple of years with a postdoc at UCSB, working with a group there that's looking at experiences and cognitive science in a religious studies setting.
Can we take a moment and just talk a little bit more about cognitive science? Because unless you're really looking at it straight on, is it neuroscience? Is it evolutionary psychology? Exactly. And it's kind of between those two in a way. Yeah. But it would be good to hear a little bit about how you – or the important ideas in it that have really been useful for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to the way that the cognitive science of religion has been shaped over the last couple of decades, it's been really dominated by evolutionary psychology and cognitive psychology with an evolutionary basis, let's say. And only in more recent years, you really started to see more sort of neurocognitive models also being used to look at also experiential dimensions.
Let me just parse that. The way that I hear what you're saying is that the evolutionary psychology approach is going to be like, look, our minds and their architecture and how they're built is all developed, you know, Paleolithic and beyond. So we can really understand a lot of contemporary mental experience and behavior based on the stories that we tell, you know, based in good fact and good reasoning, but often these sort of stories about what happened in the past. But the neurocognitive approach is more based on what we can understand now through experimental studies and through even cognitive philosophy about how our brains work, you know, in our contemporary situation, with less emphasis on this story from the past. Is that right?
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of it. So it's partially how you go about studying things. I mean, what kind of experiments you use, because I mean, evolutionary psychologists also do experiments, but they are, you know, more classical psychology experiments where you do like perceptual tests or whatever, right? So it doesn't necessarily involve fMRI scanners or PET scanners or these kind of big machines where you check what kind of brain patterns are being activated while you do certain tasks, which is more the neurocognitive approach. But just to continue on that, so the within the cognitive science of religion, there's really been this, with this evolutionary focus, there's been a real attempt or agenda to try and explain the features of religious thought, let's say, and also practice that are grounded in normal ways of doing things that we've basically been biased to due to our evolutionary history, right? And so it really has this kind of normalizing agenda in a sense that religious conceptions are nothing special. For me, that's also been valuable, trying to understand esotericism in those terms, that some of the things that strike us as weird about, say, the correspondence thinking of the Renaissance actually isn't that weird when you look at how it is easy, how humans start creating concepts, and what's an easy way for us to create concepts and relate things and categorize things. It doesn't really come across as that weird. But still, there is a kind of a hiatus here if you want to look at these really extraordinary experiences that people are reporting. To look at those, you really come up a little bit short with the evolutionary perspectives. And that's where some of the more recent cognitive neuroscience is starting to give some interesting results, I think, that we can use to look at this as well. By engaging in certain practices, we can cultivate mental imagery, for example, in certain ways, so that we will be more likely to we'll become better visualizers, and also perhaps being able to perceive inner voices as being produced external by an external source instead of internally, and these kind of things that I think are really more fruitful if you want to look at how these experiences come about.
Yeah, just for people who've listened to the show, we had an interview with Tanya Lerman about a year ago that overlapped with some of these questions about how it is that people learn to recognize phenomena in their heads like a voice, and at what point do we start to hear that as an outside voice, and what practices do we do, active practices over time that help create the opportunity for those kinds of perceptions. So what I hear you saying, and what I really enjoy about your work, as I mature as a thinker, partly through going through school, is that it's not that I become more skeptical in the kind of popular sense of that term, which is I think an unfortunate and somewhat often a somewhat parodic stance. But I am more interested in how we can use these kinds of rational ways of understanding in order to get closer and closer to the nub of these still extraordinary events, but not with an agenda of simply writing them off, which you often find in the cognitive science and religion, where there's almost a kind of attack mode or a sort of smugness about, now we have a good story. You know, for example, just to give people a familiar example is, you know, the tendency we have to believe that there are agents, mysterious agents in the world, gods, nature spirits, is really just a function of the fact that for evolutionary reasons, we're just better off thinking that that rustling sound in the bush is potentially a tiger or a threatener than some random thing that's just happening. So we're just better off thinking that there might be agents everywhere. And that, so we get selected for that. So that's why we can explain the fact that almost everywhere in the world, all traditions have this sense of incorporeal agents. Well, that's a pretty good explanation in a lot of ways. I think it gets you part of the way. But there also seems to be room, and I think your work does it, and some of the scholars that you work with, like Ann Taves, that even though it's largely skeptical in that sense, or naturalistic, looking at
naturalistic,
it in terms of...
Yeah, I prefer that term.
Yeah, so looking at it in terms of this is something that nature and as natural beings we are doing, that there's a kind of respect or interest with the extraordinariness of some of these things, and there's a kind of openness as well towards these extraordinary experiences.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I never really understood was this connection between this perceived connection between explaining and explaining away the significance of something. You know, why would it be the case that once you can give some sort of explanation of some phenomenon, it loses its value? To me, that's a complete non sequitur. I don't quite see how it follows. So that's part of my starting point, and I think also the starting point for Anne Taves that you just mentioned when we're working now on this, what we call the building block approach, which is basically seeing these mechanisms, like you were talking about agent detection and all the things like that, as building blocks for complex cultural phenomena that have these as component parts, but where you really need to look at how they are put together and how they are used by actual human beings to really assess the broader significance. Gives broader functions also. But in order to do that, you need to have this sort of back and forth between people working on different levels as well. So you can't just sort of throw out the humanists and get a bunch of neuroscientists in the room to study these things. You need to have a conversation that goes across these levels. So that's really one of the big challenges. But also the big promise, I think, of working in this landscape.
Yeah, let's try to do a little more specifics on the building block approach, and particularly around the idea of event. And I'll just start it with a very vague, you're going to say it a lot better than I am, but the sense that if you're talking about an extraordinary experience, let's say you have a vision of God or a sense of God in your voice, and it becomes a remarkable source of meaning for you, and then it changes your life, or it changes the way you think about things, and you report it to other people, some of the approaches that you're talking about is one where you get down as fine as you can in terms of an individual's account, or if you're dealing with somebody in you know, real life, or I mean who's alive and can tell you the story, you kind of break it down. You know, ideally they're in an fMRI, but if they're not that, even if it's just an historical account, you can sit there and go, okay, let's break this down. At some point they're cruising along, they're having normal experience, and then something happens. And one of the things that happens when you start to feel the presence, you have chills up your spine, is the sense that something extraordinary is happening, something different than the normal. Already, we're doing cognitive work. It's not just that we're having a weird experience. There's a part of us that's going, I'm having a weird experience.
Yeah.
And then there's a voice, let's say, and we go, that voice is not coming from me, as opposed to someone who maybe has a lot of maybe they're maybe they hear voices in like the way we associate with schizophrenics, but they've learned to deal with it. People like that go, oh, I hear voices sometimes. It doesn't sound like me, but I don't really believe them anymore. It's not as big a deal. But for someone that hasn't had that experience, they might go, oh my God, I'm hearing a voice from outside. That's another little phase where it's actually quite complicated what's going on. And so the building block approach is trying to get down to that really fine grain level of these multiple dimensions that construct our experience.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. And one thing that you sort of pointed to there too is how incredibly important appraisals are. You know, that it's really about how does an individual appraise what's happening to them? How do they appraise the significance? Is it just a thought, or is it the thought of somebody else that's put in your head, or is it somebody speaking to you, or in your environment, or inside of your mind? These are basically appraisal processes. And what's significant about that is that, so there's of course this sort of basic, you know, you could take a basic cognitive approach to that too, you know, how appraisal is a part of the way that we think in general, but there's also significant cultural layering on this, where, you know, there would be learning processes involved, where you'd be learning to pay attention to certain kinds of stimuli, and you would be learning to discern between certain kinds of things that are more relevant to you than others. And all of this really gets kind of tuned in cultural practices. And so that's kind of the direction that we want to go with this as well, is what do people do with what they're given, so to speak, and how do they tune their cognitive machinery through cultural practices.
You know, when you describe that, what comes to my mind, and I think this is a good analogy because it's a lot shared by a lot of people and probably a lot of people who are listening, even if just in a casual way, is yoga, contemporary yoga. And a contemporary yoga class, you can go in and at first point, you know, you're mostly just doing the physical postures. And, you know, the teacher is mostly talking you through physical postures. And they might start off the class with some general kind of new agey self-help ideas about getting in touch with whatever. And they don't really specifically describe the practice very much. But with a lot of teachers, because of the way that they're trained and their own interests, because they're really deep into it, if you practice more and more, you know, things start happening that are unusual, senses of energy, senses of great feeling, you know, parts of your body that you're sensing that you never have before, whatever the quote unquote energy is. And you'll notice that different teachers will start to point out certain things that step away from physiology, that step away from what you would encounter in a, you know, in a gym class or a course on biophysiology. And those terms, they have more of a religious background or a kind of new age background. The chakras are the great example. Can you feel the energy in your heart or the energy in your third eye? And I've been aware of seeing how experiences that I'm having are relating in some sense to these stories that I'm getting that could probably be different in different situations. In fact, they are. Different teachers have different ways of describing this kinds of experience, but you're also unfolding into it, and you start to notice that, well, yes, I do feel a strange sense of warmth in my heart area or in my third eye area. And so you're part, you know, just even if you're not doing it as a religious seeker, you can notice the way that these processes that you're describing are shaping your experience.
Exactly.
So, I'd like to hear a little bit more about like how you have brought some of these tools to bear on particular questions in esotericism, in magic, in the occult. Because I mean, I wanted to mention that you've really done a lot of great work on the occult. I think it was your master's thesis you turned into a wonderful book called "Arguing with Angels," which is just the best overall historical account of the Enochian system. You know, developed by John Dee and then becoming a part of The Golden Dawn and Aleister Crowley, and is still a very important part of contemporary occult practice. And we've had occultists, you know, and occult practitioners, scholars on the show. And, you know, so you've gone very deep into certain veins of esoteric and occult practices and experiences. So what makes you interested in this stuff, maybe even looking forward, like the next project that you want to do? Yeah. How are you bringing these cognitive tools to bear on some specifically esoteric or occult questions?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on this actually right now. There's some sort of in the middle of it, and still not entirely sure. You know, you probably know this feeling, having just finished a PhD dissertation, you know, that terrifying moment when you're in the middle of sort of finishing up writing some things, but still figuring out which way the argument goes and not entirely sure if it's holding. So that's a little bit where I am now. But I'm doing some work on precisely on sort of Golden Dawn style ritual magic and the visualization practices that are being used there, especially as they relate to these categories, experiential categories of clairvoyance, scrying, and astral travel. Actually the example you just mentioned with yoga, I'm finding that it's not for nothing that somebody like Aleister Crowley incorporated yoga in his magical training programs as well for his order in the early 20th century, the AA, because there are some really clear parallels in terms of how you start the training process with teaching postures, teaching ways of moving the body, partially through ritualization, certain ritual actions that are then connected to specific goals related to agents like angels, the Enochian angels, for example, vibrating god names, these kind of things that are powerfully mixed up in correspondence systems, which would trigger all sorts of mental conceptions of planets and, you know, alchemical concepts and whatnot. So that's kind of training process that's connected to bodily actions. And then taking that sort of internalizing that and using those sort of things in visualization practices where you're kind of entering an internal world. I'm finding that using also the kind of stuff that Tanya Lerman has been working on, so since you mentioned her already, on inner sense cultivation, is really helping us to get a few steps further from sort of just looking at the textual material towards saying something about what's actually going on, both on a phenomenological level and also on a more deeper sort of biocognitive level. And what's exciting, of course, with this kind of material is that you are not only bound to historical sources, because obviously there are people doing a lot of this stuff still today. So it's not like you couldn't also do ethnographic work, talk to people, interview, also, of course, do experimental studies. And it's not a secret. I would like at some point in the future to be able to do some experimental work on this. It would be amazing to actually conduct ritual magic in a laboratory.
Yeah, I think that's sort of where we're going in a lot of ways, in terms of, I mean, if you just look at the history of how meditation and yoga have been, you know, heavily studied in laboratory settings, and the reason that happened is often the very historical ones, that those practices were recognized as reasonably legitimate forms of altered states production, or whatever you want to call it, coming from a religious source, but from the late 60s and certainly into the 70s, it was like that was the go-to place for the altered states that we could study that didn't have the problems of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. But ritual magic, which uses very different approaches in a lot of ways, because you are there's more cognitive work doing, because there's often a lot of building up of symbols and associations rather than a kind of a paring down into these states of focus and concentration. So there's something fundamentally different going on in a lot of these practices, but they're just as rich and valuable to approach from these experimental levels. But it's also funny because it's already kind of part of the story in a way. You know, I'm thinking of these, Have you read the William Hope Hodgson's Carnacki, the Ghost Story fictions? Have you ever read those?
No, I don't think I'm familiar with that.
Oh, you'd love him, man, because he's basically a psychic detective. Right. And, you know, so he's studying esoteric materials or ghosts or hauntings or demons. He's a scientist type, like a Sherlock Holmes guy. Yeah. But he uses these there's a thing that he has called an electric pentagram, which is this like a steampunk device that he uses in order to call up these sort of entities. So there's this really interesting kind of overlap already between these sort of technical approaches, using technology, using scientific ideas in order to stage or explore these more incorporeal dimensions. So you'd enjoy them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I don't think it would be difficult to find subjects who would be interested in trying this kind of stuff out in laboratories, precisely because of this pre-existing convergence, let's say, between ritual magic and technology. And we're starting to get also better kind of equipment for doing this, because, I mean, obviously you can't do ritual magic in an fMRI scanner. You can't move around and do your invocations. But now you've got other sorts of measures you can use. You can use a wearable EEG. You can use eye tracking devices. There's all sorts of measures that are now relatively cheap that you can have on your body without it really encumbering you, and you can still go around and draw your pentagrams. So, I think the time is ripe for it.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking with the example of the Carnacki was that gets into another aspect of your work, and particularly your dissertation work, is this question of disenchantment and how occultism and parapsychology play into it. So the basic, very influential sociological ideas first articulated by Max Weber, a century or so ago, is that the West, the modernity, is fundamentally driven by this process of disenchantment, that the mysterious forces, the unknown entities, significant mysteries that exist, let's say, in the lives of people 200, 300, and certainly 500, 600 years ago, is being steadily eroded by the processes of science and technology and other things. This is a simplistic way of describing it, but it's the basic background. But it's widely shared, that when you have modernity, you have disenchantment. Now, increasingly, people question that from a lot of different reasons, the most obvious being that a lot of people 50 years ago thought that religion was on the way out. It's like, once you start using tools, once you start using modern capitalism, once you start using science, religion's over with. That clearly has not happened, even in the West. But you have much more subtle and interesting ways, to my mind, of talking about how the disenchantment idea is not exactly what's going on if you look at the history of occultism of parapsychology, but particularly the way that these things interact with what we think of as science. And I know it's a very complicated topic, but I just love a little bit to hear about, are we right to still think about disenchantment in terms of our modern experience? How are things more complicated than that? And why are things more complicated than that?
So as you kind of noted, the idea of disenchantment, in its strongest formulation anyway, is that mysterious incalculable forces are disappearing from our worldviews. That we don't expect to find any genuine mysteries in the order of nature. Now, if we take that as on its strongest formulation as a statement of, let's say a prediction of what we should find when we look at what's happening, then it's just factually incorrect, right? It's just not what we're seeing. So for me, this is something that, a lot of people have been saying for quite a while, and it's actually given rise to this whole school of thinking in the sociology of religion about re-enchantment, that we're seeing this, that after disenchantment, we got this reaction of re-enchantment, where the world is again becoming infused with mystery and meaning and all these kind of things. So, you know, I don't like this these binary ways of thinking, I guess, that you see in this. And so what I ended up trying to do instead was to, and I think this is actually more in line with Weber's own thinking as well, is that the processes of disenchantment, to the extent that that is a real thing, it didn't so much do away with these mysterious incalculable forces as it made them problematic in various ways. So that's, you know, therefore the title of my book, The Problem of Disenchantment, that due to the way that scientific and technical disciplines try to explain the world and the way that we organize our societies through technology and sort of social engineering, because of all this, our very common experience that things don't really work that way are difficult to square with the explanations that we're being taught in school. And that's a problem. And people can find various ways, creative ways to deal with that. They can try and suppress this, you know, denying that there is anything else than what you've taught, or you can try and live with this basically cognitive dissonance type thing, or you can try and propose various alternatives that try to incorporate that. And that's, I think, what you see in a lot of the sort of, alternative science directions that also include parts of parapsychology, and definitely within occultism and the so-called New Age.
An example here would just as to give an example would be quantum physics and you know, right, focusing on those elements in quantum physics that even the most hard-headed skeptic who understands physics will recognize are extremely peculiar. You know, they'll even call it weird, you know, weird stuff, and that people from the outside then go, okay, there's some weirdness there. That weirdness can be part of an explanation or a way of understanding other kinds of things that have a quality of enchantment.
Exactly. So one of the things that I also did in that book, which is did not rely so much on the cognitive stuff because I was just starting to dabble with that, but it's really more of an intellectual history type thing, was to also try and trace a number of like controversies within mainstream science in the period of the early 20th century, which seemed to me to revolve fundamentally about around these kind of basically mysterious incalculable forces. So quantum physics being one of them, the most noticeable one perhaps, but also you had this vitalism controversy that's been kind of constant in the biological life sciences, erupting also in the 20s and 30s. And this whole notion of emergence theories and organicism connected with that, which again are sort of spinning pretty influential schools of thought from within sort of the core of the Western academy as well. So it's not like this is completely marginal stuff. It's real intellectual problems that people are struggling with inside the academy as well. So those kind of more complicated stories was part of what I wanted to tell with that.
Well, I'd love to have you reflect a little bit about now. I mean, we talked about quantum physics, but other places where you see this complexity happening, meaning not an example of when people who are not really scientists are creating sort of alternative science in the sort of shadows of things that conventional science or would recognize, like quantum entanglement or something like that, but places where there really is a sort of fusion. I mean, contemporary parapsychology is a good example where, you know, I've met a lot of parapsychologists and I haven't studied it enough to come to some kind of rationalist conclusion about, yes, there's a phenomenon, no, there's not a phenomenon, because it's very complicated. But I do know that these people are really legitimate methodological scientists, and in fact they think about methodology much more acutely than a lot of other scientists do, because nobody's hassling them for their scientific protocols nearly as much as the parapsychologists. So the parapsychologists are very aware of the functioning of science, even as they are sort of carving out room for some kinds of mysterious forces. Mm-hmm. So whether you want to talk about parapsychology or maybe another example, Where are some really interesting places right now where we're seeing some of this interchange?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can talk a little bit about parapsychology because there's another, I think, interesting point to be made here with the contemporary parapsychologists is that the kind of scientifically minded person who, you know, is typically an experimentalist studying some really precise function of psi, they would generally be completely open about the fact that they don't really have a theory for how this would work. They don't have any mechanism. They don't know, you know, how this could be. They're just strictly looking at sort of an empirical issue. And that's, I guess, one way to deal with this as well, that if you're coming at these sort of things when something goes bump in the night and you want to explore it as some sort of supernatural, or not supernatural, but a paranormal, let's say, phenomenon, and you're coming at that from within the sciences, the explanatory schemes that you have cannot grasp them. So you have to sort of either come up with something radically different or go for this other approach, which these contemporary parapsychologists exemplify, of a radical form of empiricism, where you're just sort of pointing to weird data points. And that's also, I think, one of the frustrations with parapsychology, why it has had such great problems getting any broader recognition than it has. I mean, it's done pretty well for itself for being such a, you could say, a weird kind of outgrowth of the academy. But the fact that they cannot really build cumulative theory on this, I think, is really one of the sort of persistent problems of trying to make science out of these mysterious incalculable forces. You're starting to see that.
It's interesting. I mean, we had Dean Radin on the show, and my favorite thing, it's like it stayed with me. It's organized my thought. So I asked him, like, okay, you've been doing this forever. You've been working really hard. You've been, you know, as straight up and rationalist about this as you can. What's the thing you've learned the most? And he said, without a beat, I don't actually may not have said it on the show, but it was a conversation I had with him before. He said, the sociology of science, meaning that it's not about what this experiment shows on some level. It's not about whether or not you, looking at the information from whatever position you're at, say, yes, something's here, or no, that's not there. It's not really about that. It's really about how these things then develop momentum and move outside into other fields and start to impact larger questions. Because as long as that doesn't happen, then it remains largely where it is, which is this weird little world that if you start to look at, it becomes very interesting. And my experience is that being a fairly skeptical person, or knowing how to think skeptically, I've looked at stuff that I go, okay, that's some kind of statistical thing. That's something is there that seems weird. It's there. Like, we got to like acknowledge at least that this anomalous sort of material is there, and it seems like the protocols are really good. But what do you do with this? However, I want to throw an interesting thing at you. Maybe it's a little bit, you know, from left field, but I was just talking to a friend of mine the other night who works in robotics and artificial intelligence.
Right. Yeah.
And one of the things that's happening now in AI and in big data is that people who are getting – and he was sort of saying this from the knowledge point of view, saying like, look, PhDs are coming to me now with ways of asking big data questions or creating algorithmic ways to go into, you know, enormous fields of data and coming up with answers to questions and answers that are actionable. They're good. We can use them. We can move with them. I mean, a classic example is just the kind of recommendation software that they give you on Amazon. It's a simple example, but knowing all the stuff that you've done, well, I can predict X and Y. But we can – that kind of associational data thinking can happen with much more complicated data sets with much more variables and a lot more different sorts of dimensions to it. And we can get real knowledge out of it. But what my friend said is, he goes, I don't know whether these guys deserve a PhD, because if you ask them, why is this happening? They don't have an answer. what they have is say, look, I know we can ask these kinds of questions, throw it into the computer, goes through its algorithmic processes, and get these answers out that we can really use. So there's a dimension of contemporary scientific practice at the heart of the hot world of AI, of these processes that are already changing our world, are going to significantly change our world in 5-10 years, where there's this weird kind of ignorance, this weird kind of like, well, the machines, the algorithms were able to do this. That's all I need, because all I really want is the actionable information. I don't actually need to know why these particular things are correlated the way they are. And I, and so what I, and it's really stuck with me. I was like, wow, that's so weird. And now when you're talking, I'm like, wow, that's really interesting, because in a way, you know, from another angle, how much, you know, it'd be great to have a wonderful explanatory principle for why paranormal psychology seems to occasionally show really anomalous data, but maybe we're just not going to know, or you know what I mean? There's a weird connection there. I don't know if that's a little left field.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, I was actually, I'm also struck now by the, because I've been following this whole deep learning debate also recently with AlphaGo, and, you know, the recent breakthrough there with the reigning Go champion now being dethroned by a neural network, basically. And what struck me there is that really the gold standard for these AI researchers is to create something that does genuinely surprising things, you know, stuff that you didn't program it to do, that learns by itself and starts behaving as some sort of independent agent. So you're starting off with a mechanical system and you're ending with a complex learning thing that starts doing stuff that you didn't predicted to do in the first place. And I mean, it's an interesting kind of spin on this whole mysterious incalculable force kind of thing, right? Maybe we come to the point where to kind of fall back into the Weberian narrative. We had disenchanted the world, but then we invented the gods. you know, it's, yeah, I don't know what's in store for us.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, and I'm really glad you're doing that. And I wanted to ask a little bit also about, I mean, you know, I assume that you, like a lot of people, you got interested in esoteric material when you were, you know, a young man, and were probably interested in it for all sorts of ways, not necessarily particularly academic ones. I'm not trying to like get your, you know, your lodge membership out in the air or whatever, but I'm kind of curious how the reasons that you first became attracted and fascinated with this stuff, which is so widely spread, particularly among adolescents, and then some of us stay with it in various ways, and how that sort of shifted, and how whether even at the beginning of your studies, when you were mostly doing things historically, whether your kind of interest or openness to these kinds of experiences have changed. In what ways are you, more likely to take somebody's report, you know, sort of less with more grains of salt than you were, or do you still feel in some ways like that there's something here, there's something in these traditions, there's something in these practices that people continue to carry forward that kind of has its own, part of reality. It's its own, making its own claims, or it's carving out a space that's not just some frivolous way of like tweaking your mind, but that there's some real kind of substance that has a real deep meaning behind it.
Well, I think I've always been sort of driven by curiosity and wanting to know more about this stuff that nobody was telling me about, right? Sure, I might have been more kind of personally, you know, hoping to find the Holy Grail of some sort or other when I was a teenager than I am now. But I think generally I've been sort of having a pretty steady course. For me, I mean, there's lots of different ways that I got into this. I think the serious interest really started growing after I'd been playing a lot of role-playing games and starting to get curious about, you know, what's the real thing behind this? You know, there are references here to magicians in history. And if I check it in a book, I see that this actually is a historical person. And then you start looking at things a bit more. So basically by the end of high school, I was just absorbing a lot of really eclectic, broadly mystical, esoteric literature from, you know, the Nag Hammadi Gnostic library and Hermetic texts to Rudolf Steiner and John Dee and Aleister Crowley. So it was really kind of starting there and then developing an interest for all this weird stuff that was not in my history books, let's say, but it was in my role-playing books, but it also seemed to be a real thing. So I really got interested that way, I think. And I was fortunate enough to be able to look at this at when I started university and had a particularly open-minded religious studies professor who was able to show me in the right direction. You should probably read Francis Yates. And then there is this guy in Amsterdam, Wouter Hanegraaff, who you might want to get in touch with and maybe do your master's there. And that's kind of how it's all turned into a big sort of academic professional thing instead.
That's a wonderful story. We've had Wouter on the show as well, but I wanted to make one point about D&D. And in fact, I think in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be interviewing Jeremy Crawford, who worked on the fifth edition of D&D, which has done very well. There's a revival. But one of the interesting things about D&D, it comes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that in addition to the lore, the books, and then the game tech of you know, dice and sort of the way in which it's structured, that it is also a collective practice of imagination. And you
absolutely.
You got this DM, he's saying you're in a room, da 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 da, and you have to really think about, imagine the room, where's the dwarves coming from, where's the fireball, and where you're standing. And so you're sitting there with and you're building a visionary world that is using the same kinds of mechanisms that we build when we're doing this like more specifically occult or Christian imagination work. You know, I mean, it's not like it's the practice of the imagination is located only in esotericism. It's really a widely spread feature of human.
No, absolutely. Religion.
Do you still play?
I'm unfortunately not. I mean, well, D&D was never my main thing anyway, but I've been missing some good role-playing action, I must say. But, you know, it's just not so so easy to combine with...
well, you work pretty hard.
Yeah, there's that.
So if it wasn't D&D, what were you into?
Well, lots of things, but I guess the biggest universe was the World of Darkness, the universe of the White Wolf series. They had, vampire and mage and demon and this very sort of dark, esoteric, set in present day, alternative real world type scenario type thing. That's very appealing to a teenager.
Yeah, no, let's just, we only have just a few minutes left, but I just want to get in a question here, is that now we see that there's much more a culture in popular culture. I mean, it was always there in a little bit, but, you know, in the counterculture, it was still kind of oppositional, like, and even in your experience, it was something you had to dig for. And now it's just everywhere, you know, there's pop vampires, it's all on the internet, it's like, and so if you're a young kid coming up and you have those same kinds of interests, the whole sense of, you know, for my generation, and you're younger than me, but even I think for you, there is still something kind of quote unquote esoteric just about finding out about who John Dee was or this or that. Mm-hmm. But now, like, I read comic books, there's Alan Moore, there's whatever. It's just part of the mix. Mm. And I'm wondering whether you see, whether through the knowledge of, you know, your knowledge of contemporary occult practitioners or your sense of history, whether the kinds of really deep work that some occultists do and have done in terms of structuring the imagination, in terms of complex ritual work, in terms of really working hard on developing those new capacities, is that threatened by the kind of miasma of pop culture that just kind of, you know, exists everywhere? Do you see the practice of esotericism really changing because of the changing media conditions?
Yeah, well, changing, certainly, but I don't think it's threatened. I don't think so. I mean, I think if you look at, you know, people who are doing this kind of complex and difficult sort of ritual stuff and caliphatic imaginary practices and that kind of stuff, it's they were always kind of still relatively small communities, not many people. What you have now is that the exposure to these ideas and the inroads to the communities that are doing the difficult stuff are perhaps, you know, becoming more accessible. So if anything, I would actually predict that more people would get involved with this kind of stuff. But you would really need to study this empirically to figure that out. But certainly, I mean, well, popular culture is becoming a big sort of socializing factor for esotericists, basically, and that is an interesting development. What happens when you start learning Enochian from TV shows like Supernatural? I mean, it's definitely a different mode of socialization that we're seeing now.
And I think another dimension of it is that there's more and more of a culture of exploring altered states, not necessarily in a kind of context where, like, oh, I'm going to be building my mind so that I can communicate with my holy guardian angel. It's more like, let's see how we can intensify conscious, like, our weird experience without necessarily having as many overbeliefs. I mean, there's some Reddit threads where people are trying to do what look like kind of scary occult rituals of producing things with mirrors and shadows and noise. But there's not a sense of like, okay, we're doing this in order to contact supernatural forces or whatever. It's almost more like we can just do this. We can play with the knobs and of our own minds. So that's another dimension of it too.
Absolutely. Totally. I think that playful attitude is probably stronger now than it was, although it has, I think, always been there as well, at least as, you know, a way to start getting involved. And then maybe you start out playing with stuff, and then something happens, right? And then the appraisal process is set in. So,
That's a very good point. Well, I think we're going to have to end it there. Agil, thanks so much for talking. Once again, heterodoxology.com is a way to track his work. And if you're interested in more, I encourage you to sign up to academia.edu and get papers from him and lots of other stuff. It's a great way to track contemporary scholarship. So best of luck. You got a new gig at the University of Stockholm?
Yeah, I do. Thanks a lot. I'm starting there over the summer, so that should be exciting. Finally get some stability.
Very good. Well, great. Good luck with that. And
thanks.
Thank you. So, bye. For me to all you out there, keep your minds open.